overflowing with love. I am overflowing with happiness. I am filled with the power to make a change, to create a brand new life.
Welcome to the podcast of the Sunday Celebration from the Center of Spiritual Living in Huntsville, Alabama. We hope you feel the grace, the beauty, and the love of our community as you hear the message of the week. Have a beautiful week.
This is a glorious day to be alive. So I invite you to enter into the breath. The most profound thing any of us can do is to rest within our own breath, the breath that is breathing us, the breath of life, and to just experience the simplicity of it and yet the profoundness of it. To consciously breathe assists us in stepping away from thought patterns that oftentimes trigger emotional patterns. And just by tethering ourselves in that simple inhalation and exhalation, we can discover there is an emptiness behind all thought. There is a field of awareness that precedes all thought. And we are that. So as Lord Buddha would say, awareness is the Lord of everything. And when this awareness awakens within our hearts and minds, that we are this field of awareness that is fully conscious, and we are always at choice point, whether we will follow a thought pattern, whether we will engage an emotional reaction, or whether we will just simply observe it. We were speaking in our revealing service about the evolution of consciousness and how we all entered our spiritual journey, perhaps as a bit of a mess. But then through practice, through meditation, prayer, treatment, and through having lived a long life, we've learned how to be responsible, able to respond to what life brings us, and not necessarily let it spin us out of control. And so when anxiety arises, and there has been a lot of anxiety, largely because of a coronavirus that we've all been a part of, a journey, and we now can witness it almost from looking back at it. I had my first shot on Friday, and I feel very confident that we are getting through this thing together. And we're going to be stronger and more resilient and more resolved to be a kinder, gentler country as a result of having been close to the possibility of death. We've also been given the opportunity to observe death all around us, and then also to observe what doesn't die, what is here behind the appearance of death, which is the aliveness of spirit. And so for one, I am deeply grateful for being here, for having this awareness flowering. Even at the beautiful age of 72, I feel that every day I am more awake and more alert and more attentive to a sacredness of every breath, of every moment. And I ride that breath with you to this place called home that exists within us. We have a pillow in our classroom that says, what lies before us and what lies behind us are small matters to what lies within us. And so we come here to access that which lies within. Parker Palmer called it a hidden wholeness at the center of our being. Dr. Ernest Holmes says it is this perception of wholeness that is all healing. And so when we reference the wholeness that is hidden within all of us, and we call that the truth of our being, then whatever appearances might be arising in the body of our experience are merely experiences. And so when our body gives us an ache or a pain, we bring that compassionate awareness to the body's message. And we say, I hear you, and I am here for you. When the emotional body comes up, and maybe an exiled part of ourselves surfaces, and we feel a vulnerability and a fragility, and maybe our transgressions are showing up, as a friend of mine said, well, then we embrace those transgressions, those parts of ourself that we're uncomfortable with. And as we learn to listen attentively, without comment or judgment, well, then we feel heard at a deep, deep level. And it was Carl Rogers, the famous psychologist, that says, all anyone ever really needs is to be heard. So it must start with self, and then it ripples out into the world. We can hear others. We can hear what they're not saying. And in that ability to be heard and to hear, we feel held in the arms of grace, forever safe in the arms of love. Like a child who needs protection from a mother's warm embrace, we are held in the hands of grace. So here at the Center for Spiritual Living, we get to fall into grace together, a grace that is, by its very nature, the unmerited givingness of the universe to its creation, and we are that creation, and we are also the grace that abounds. In the simplicity of that realization, we set ourselves free. We set ourselves free of our sins, which here at the Center for Spiritual Living we call self-inflicted nonsense. We no longer identify with that finite self that wails and suffers, but rather we identify with this divine presence that lies stretched in smiling repose at the center of our being, in that hidden wholeness which is our true nature. It is a coming home to the God of our being, the good of our soul, the potential and possibility of the universe, all waiting for our recognition, our unification, our declaration, our gratitude, and our release in realizing that it is already there. With playful participation in the universe, I invite you to open your eyes, enter into the sacred moment, put your hands together, let me see your smiles under those masks, open your hands, and let your little fingers wiggle, because you have arrived in the playful universe called life, and we're in this together. So thank you for coming to play with me on Sunday morning. It's so nice to see you sitting out there with your masks on, safe spaced. A dear friend from the past came to see us this Sunday morning, and it's always nice to make that heart connection to someone you've known for a very long time. You know, we call ourselves the Center for Spiritual Living, and as a new minister, I studied with a man named Michael Beckwith in California, and Michael Beckwith said, people come to our centers for a reason, for a season, or a lifetime. And I happen to be a lifetimer. I think Sylvia's a lifetimer. Some people come for a reason. I remember I got a phone call at the old church, and it was a guy that was from Unity on the Mountain. He says, you got any pretty women at your church? Uh-huh. And I said, I don't think that they're going to be interested in you. So he had a reason, but it never really manifested. And then some people come and they get what they need for a season, and it's good. You know, maybe they come and they do meet their right and perfect mate, and then they move to Asheville, North Carolina, as Sylvia and Joe did, and then their ministry expanded in that locale. But that seasonal thing is also very valuable. I was setting up the center for this morning, and I changed the clocks back with Adam's help, and I was playing music in the classroom, and there was a CD from Larry Tedford. Larry Tedford, Judy will remember, he was our first musician. Well, Judy was really our first. She played the piano at the old center. But then Larry Tedford was a young man who offered his services, and he played the guitar. And every Sunday morning, he would come up here with his guitar, and he would sing, there is only love, there is only love. And ultimately, having stayed here for the time that he was here, he made a CD. Now, I haven't seen Larry Tedford in 25 years. I've been a minister for 32. But I listened to that CD, and the last song that he wrote was a song called I Have Arrived, I Am Home. And he says, and it's from this little calligraphy that Thich Nhat Hanh did, and he says, to a family that is always there for me, and even when I'm not there, he says, I know that the love that I received is still with me. And so here in me listening to Larry Tedford, who maybe left 25 years ago, I still feel that he's still here. So what if that's the beautiful opportunity for all of us, is to identify with that which doesn't come and go. And that is our true nature. That's this eternal something that we all get to experience in this impermanent form that we've all been given. So if you study Buddhism, and when Sylvia can appreciate this, when I was a new minister, well-meaning folks would want me to launch into a successful ministry. So I got maybe 100 different Bibles. I have them all in the bookcase. Not too, they almost like brand new. Then I was also given, will you give me a glass of water, Adam? I was also given all the world's religions. There's the Upanishads, there's the Bhagavad Gita, there's the Dharmapada. And I thought, what do they expect of me? Obviously, they have expectations because they have all the volumes. I should give those to you, Jake, and you can read the world's religions. Only to realize it's not in a book. You need to put the book down and to find that same truth as it awakens within you. So what I've learned is that in my beautiful life, oh, I was going to share with you that this shirt that I'm wearing today, I'm wearing it for a purpose. This is the shirt that I wore 3 years ago on March 12th. This is March 14th, when I had the massive heart attack that I wasn't supposed to survive from. Now, Trey, when I went, I was wheeled into the emergency room, and they realized what was happening. They started tearing off my clothes. And I can remember thinking, I haven't had anybody tear my clothes off in a hell of a long time. I think maybe I was in my 20s. And I was 69 at the time, and I remember asking them, please don't tear the shirt, it's my favorite shirt. So they managed not to tear the shirt, and I did manage to survive. So Trey wanted me to throw the shirt out. He's my husband of 3 years. After the heart attack, we got married. We've been together 45 years. And so he said that this is an unlucky shirt. And I said, honey, it's a lucky shirt, I'm alive. Why would you call it an unlucky shirt? And so it's, you know, that's just perception. And so when I put it on, I feel the grace of living. And when I came out of that experience where they put the stent in the heart, the first thing that the emergency woman said in the emergency room is, you're not supposed to be here. Now, that's not something you want to hear when you're coming out of anesthesia. No. And then she said, you had the widowmaker, and they don't, you know, and I thought, enough information. The first visitor that came to see me in the hospital room told me that her mother had like 10 stints and it became a way of life. I said, too much information, don't need this. I just want to be in gratitude for the grace and the mystery. And the doctor, you know what they say is true. I looked up and he was this young doctor from Massachusetts. His name was Joseph Krasnow. And I said, you saved my life, didn't you? And he said, yep, I did. And I said, so I guess I owe it to you. He says, well, don't mess it up then. And then he says, do you have any worries? And I said, well, I only have one worry. I said, I'm 69. And I said, my husband is 70. He said, oh, he was a real child, a cradle robber, wasn't he? And then I started to laugh and I said, you know, I like you. And we've had this lovely relationship. So what if he came into my life and I came into his for an encounter? And that's true for all of us. There are no accidents. We each came into each other's life for a reason, a season, or a lifetime. And if it happens to be a sustaining relationship, how grateful then is that? You know, I stand in awe of the mystery of belonging to the universe, number one, and the mystery of this law of attraction. Because it was a teacher that I studied with, Gandhiji, that says, if you chase after something, you'll never get it there. So stop chasing after Miss Right or Mr. Right or the job or the career. If you chase after anything, you'll never get it. And the other thing she said is, and if you run away from anything, you'll never get away from it. So what if we could meet what is? We're doing this wonderful class on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. It's Pema Chodron's Living Beautifully with Uncertainty and Change. And I'm talking today about beauty and living beautifully. And beauty is a wonderful word. But she talks about in that there's the three vows that you take in Buddhism. And she turned the three vows into three commitments. And I love the word commitment. It comes from the Latin word comitare, which means to focus around something that you care about. And the three commitments, or the three vows, are very simply to do no harm in this planet. And to always do your best. Well, that's a beautiful way to live, isn't it? You know, I try to be very cognizant of my carbon footprint on this planet. Trey and I recycle everything. You know, instead of bagging the leaves and leaving them out on the street, Adam was helping me. We drag the bags, leaves back to the compost heap so that it can turn into beautiful black gold that I sprinkle around the plants. So, you know, I find myself rescuing little critters on the pathways of life. I had one of those horrible moments. I called Jody Rutenberg this morning. I said, I had a Jody Rutenberg moment, Jody. I'm driving to the center early on. I'm going down Bailey Cove Road, and I notice in the middle of the road someone has run over a squirrel. I always find those things kind of sad. But as I'm getting closer, the tail started moving. And then I found myself swerving and going around that squirrel so that I wasn't the one to put it out of its misery. And then I heard Jody in my head saying, you need to put it out of its misery because he's been hit. And then by then I had gone further and there were cars behind me and I thought, absolve you of your guilt, David. So when I called Jody, she said, David, here's the quote for the day. And she handed it to me. She says, all the guilt in the world won't change the past. And all the worry in the world won't change the future. Now she said, repeat that after me. All the guilt in the past won't change the past. And all the worry over the future won't change the future. And in that holy instant, I set myself free of any kind of self-criticism about how I didn't or did respond to the squirrel. So what if life is like that? We get these simple little moments where we skillfully navigate, and sometimes we don't so skillfully navigate, but it's all okay. Because you and I are works in progress, and we're all an evolution in consciousness. And in my understanding is that we're all evolving closer to our true nature, which is our God nature. Now that's what we already are, but so many times we mistake ourselves to be separate from one another. And that is really the only sin, is to see yourself as separate from the one and to separate from each other. So you understand Jesus when he says there's only two rules. To love this presence, he called it God, with all your heart and all your soul and all your might. That's that one thing that we all share, this invisible spirit, if you will. The Brahman and the Atman are one. And the second one is to love your neighbor as yourself. We are each other. And when you're doing anything for another, you're really doing it for yourself. And that's a huge shift. And that doesn't mean just peoples. That means animals and plants and even rocks in Charlotte's case. She loves her rocks. And why not? You know, rocks. I remember I was with Cindy Swearingen and we were out on one of our spiritual retreats and there were beautiful rocks there. And unfortunately, at that time, when I was a little bit less conscious, I would take a rock and she says, you can't take a rock. They're in their rock family. You're disturbing that. And as crazy as that sounded, I could see her logic. These rocks had been in their favor for thousands of years. They were with their other fellow. Can you imagine if I took Mary away from Terry? Terry would be bereft. So she convinced me. And now think twice, Rock. Except, I know Charlotte, she gets her rocks dumped in her yard. So they've already been abused. And so, yeah, she nodded. So she can. And then she turns them into beautiful pieces of art. This is a little fish that says love on it. I think it's Michael's that you left on your chair. Did you miss your little rock, Michael? You want your rock back? Yes, he does. Everybody needs their little rock that says love. I took Char, she gives rocks away at the center on Valentine's Day. Everybody got a rock. And I have them all over the house now, thanks to you. And there's like a photograph of me in the bathroom when I was 20 years old. And I put, I love you, Reverend David, underneath that one. And then there's another little rock that has a fish kissing. And I put that by a photograph of Trey. So everywhere I look in the house, there are these little tableaus of Charlotte and her rocks to bring more beauty into my life. So that's what we're talking about today, is beauty. And this is one of my favorite classes I ever taught and one of my favorite books of all time. It's simply called Beauty by a man named John O'Donohue. He's an Irish priest who came from Connemara in Ireland, and he was in the priesthood for like 20-some years, and then he had to leave the priesthood, he says, because there was too much sin, too much transgressions, and I couldn't handle it. And then it took him into his exploration, and he went to Germany, and he studied Goethe, and he read him in Deutsch. And he wanted to know the exact sayings of Goethe, and Goethe was a mystic of the 13th century, who would say things like, the only begotten is ever begetting itself in me right now. So he took you to a higher order of being. It was Meister Eckhart that said, he who sees beauty in the smallest of things is better than seeing an angel, you know, a messenger from God. So he's inviting us to see the beauty in even the smallest of things. I was reflecting in my garden, you know, and Bubba Jake was talking about how this weather and the flowers and Adam just walking around, the trees are blooming. Trey and I were throwing the frisbee yesterday in a park, and we went under one of those saucer magnolia trees that this year they weren't burned by a hard frost. So they're massive white pink blossoms, and they were all falling down on us as we were throwing the frisbee walking under it. And I said, honey, look, all around us, it was like a carpet of white and pink petals, and we were crossing the petals. It's almost like the wedding day when the bridal girl throws the flowers. and we're walking under the tree. We're being baptized by the petals. At the same time, we're walking through it. Now, that beauty was there for me to witness it. It says in the Quran, now this is the presence of God speaking to the angel Gabriel, according to Muhammad, who dictated the Quran. And it says, I was a hidden treasure, and I longed to be known. This is God speaking, Allah. I was a hidden treasure, and I longed to be known, so I created the world. So what if we are this divine presence exposed, revealed, unfolding as that very essence of self, the big essential self that we all share? It's a whole different way of seeing life. Then it's not about you. In our satsang this Wednesday night, Gloriji quoted my favorite Zen saying. She didn't quote it correctly and she asked me to do it, but my favorite little Zen saying is, you know why you're so miserable? Because 99.9% of the things that you talk about are all about you, and you are not. And Gloriji says, when you realize that we are not, that we are just, we are a dream. We are a construct of the imagination. We are a congealed set of beliefs that can turn into a David Leonard or a Sylvia O'Neill, but that's a construct of the mind. What we are is that undifferentiated spirit which comes into form. We are emptiness dancing, and that dancing then manifests in the world. And oftentimes we can say it's beautiful, and we can look at our life and say, what a beautiful life I have. But then we can also step back behind beauty and realize that beauty is in the eye of the beholder, as they say. So what someone might say is a beautiful life to somebody else might say is a tragic life. You know, I witness these refugees coming over the border to our country, and I see them sleeping in tents, and I see these children kneeled with this thing, President Biden, please let us come in. I, in a strange sort of way, find that incredibly beautiful, that they have the courage to walk all the way to the border, to leave their country, to find a place where they can be free. My ancestors were like that. You know, they came from war-torn Ireland. I think my father's family, during the potato famine, my mother's family came over from Norway, fishermen. They lived in the Midwest. They were very close-minded Midwesterners, but they were refugees at one time. Have you ever done your ancestry.com and figure out where you all came from? I venture to say there's not a one of you that was born and came from this country, from the indigenous people. We all came from somewhere else. So I think of that as a beautiful, some people say it's a crisis at the border. I think it's a beautiful opening and a way for us to approach this thing different. As I shared with you on Friday, I got the shot. And when we drove in there, it was one of the most beautiful experiences. I had this preconceived idea, Sylvia, that they were going to stick this horse needle in my arm and I'm going to scream, that I have to stand in line. And, you know, that's what the mind does. It creates a story. But when I drove there, they had the little arrow pointing down to the road. We drove down the arrow. We followed the cones. We parked right in front of the building. Train nearly hit a policeman. That was not a good step, but he was vigilant enough not to do that. We walk in the door. They say, go to your table, your last name. They pull out a sheet. They ask you your birth date. They cross it off. Go to lady over here at this lovely table. She smiles at you, and she says, are you pregnant or breastfeeding? I said, no. Well, then roll up your sleeve, and let's have a shot. And then she says, and go into the other room. And within 15 minutes, it was all over. I said, that was one of the most pleasant experiences I've had in a long time. And so we went out and celebrated and had a panini for lunch. And, you know, it felt great. So could we see beauty in the smallest of things? When I was in Corfu, Greece, and at the height of the drama in my life, the first relationship had ended, I graduated from college, didn't know where the hell I was going. I'm 21 or 2 years old. I'm completely lost. And I met this young man, no accident, in Corfu. And he passed this idea. You know, that's what we do. We transmit ourselves. But his best friend, they were hiking in the Southern California mountains. His best friend at age 20, his name was Sun, he walked off and they never found him again. He kind of disappeared. So he was telling about his relationship with this young man and how close they were. And he had a quote that he would keep in his pocket from this young man named Sun. And he handed it to me. And it's been in my heart ever since. And this young man said, what did he say? Oh, let's see, I wrote it down here. I was trying to remember it yesterday. Oh, Sun said, he who sees beauty in the small... No, that's Meister Eckhart that said that. It's the other quote. Oh, he said, a happy person will see beauty in the same place that an unhappy person sees ugliness. A happy person will see beauty in the same place that an unhappy person sees ugliness. And then he said, I am beautiful, you are beautiful, the whole existing universe is beautiful. Ugliness is a manifestation of unhappiness. And I carried that with me. You know, I met my little unhappy self. And I saw when this unhappy self, he saw his life as he was a victim, and he would tell his story about the love affair that went wrong, only to realize it had to go wrong so I could find the love within myself, and it wasn't outside myself. Well, then you begin to look at that first relationship that went awry as this beautiful opportunity to come home to self. And what a great gift. So what if it's all about a shift in consciousness, and this beauty begins to flower when it's ready to flower? So John O'Donohue came into my life with a book called The Anamkara, which is the soul friend. And that's what you all are to me. When we meet in the soul energy, then we find purpose with our relationship. It's not attachment. It's more the soul meeting the soul, and we're meeting ourselves, and we get to flower in each other's presence. And so in this book, it's just such a beautiful treatise on love and beauty. He talks about, initially, we have to create a receptive space for this to flower within us. He says, we no longer recognize the sacred zone in which we live. This month of March, I'm talking about the sanctuary garden. And I'm using the metaphor of a garden as what we're growing within our consciousness. What if we could have our garden within and without as a sanctuary, as a sacred space? I think of this center as a sacred space, all the years that we've lived here. These are the yantras of the world religion that Virginia Burroughs, she did with her stained glass thing. There's a painting over there from a young girl right after my dog died, and it says, get off the battlefield. And in that, there is a heart and an orb, and there's a paw print, and there's a spiraling light. Etika Luckett coming to rescue my baby speck. Everything has meaning. Those two paintings in the back were the very paintings that we had in the original church, Sylvia, and they're still in the back of the room. A named Patsy Ducote, she did this beautiful painting here of the spiral of love, and she put it in the center. And then, of course, we have the Thich Nhat Hanh over my head. So what if everything in this center has a significance to those who see the significance, just like this shirt does with me? I was cold this morning, and Gigi took off her vest and put her vest on my body so I could be warm. And what I do is, in touching it, I feel the love that Gigi, when she put it on my back. Her beloved husband, Raul, has this beautiful Yul Brynner look on his head. And Gigi, years ago, she knitted me this little ear warmer. And every time I put it on, my ears feel warm, but more than anything, I feel the love that went into those stitches. And I said to Raul, I think I need to give this to you so that you could feel the love of the stitches in your ears. But I'm too selfish. I keep it in my pocket, and it keeps me warm. He says, we've lost reverence to finding the sacredness in life. And we should not be too surprised then at the lack in the quality of beauty in our experience. When you stop seeing life as sacred, you have a more difficult time seeing the beauty, he's saying. So he said, when our approach to life is respectful, it's sensitive and worthy, then gifts of healing and will challenge our creativity and open us up. When we live in gratitude, when we live in curiosity, when we live in fascination, when we wake up in the morning with the birds singing and the light shining through and saying, oh my God, I'm still alive, we're creating a sense of receptivity to the beauty that's all around, but we're beginning to see it. So he goes on to say, when we approach life with reverence, then great things decide to approach us. In this teaching, we teach a thing called the law of attraction. When you become the fashioning factor by being a beautiful soul, what do you think you're going to attract into your lives? You're going to attract more beauty. So is it about chasing after beauty out there? No, it's about becoming beautiful in here. And then by the right of law of attraction, you're going to attract the Adams and the Michaels and the Judes. They're going to be drawn to the flame. So our job is just to set ourselves on fire and notice who wants to be in the fire of transformation or who would rather stay outside and judge that fire as maybe too much. Because it is scary to step into the fire of transformation, because you won't exist anymore. The ultimate gift and the payoff is that you die into the love. And there's no more you and the love, there's just the love, and that we all share that love. That's coming home to what we are, to the beauty of our being. When we approach life with reverence, great things decide to approach us. And then our real life comes to surface, and its light awakens the concealed beauty in all things. The light awakens, feel into these words, and reveals the beauty in all things. Ernest Holmes says, love sees only love, and only love sees love. So when this love awakens, when this beauty awakens, beauty is going to see beauty everywhere. You're going to see it everywhere. I was sitting reading this on the back porch yesterday at my house, and I looked at the little tree. It's a Cotinus. It's a smoke tree. And on the Cotinus is the thread of, I assume it's eight-legged insect is a spider. The word wasn't coming. But in that thread, there was this thing that was hanging down, and I think it's the cocoon of the spider. And I'm just staring at it and thinking, are you alive? Are you dead? And then I look up at the trees, and I'm seeing all my red buds are starting to bud out. And then I look down at the ground, and the crocuses and the hyacinths and the daffodils are blooming. And then I look in my pond, and Napoleon, he's the only fish I've got left, he's looking up at me, he's making a little sound. And I'm seeing all this beauty all around just by the willingness to stop and open and look. Not with a conclusion, not with a narrative, but just with an open heart. And then you feel into it. So he's saying, beauty is mysterious. It's a slow presence who waits for the ones who are ready, the ones who have an expectant heart. So could we, Adam was telling me, he wakes up at the crack of dawn in the morning with the birds singing. I do the very same thing. And I look out of my bedroom window, and the birds are flocking all over through the trees, and I think they're making love out there, because they're really making a lot of noise. I have a mockingbird that sings all night long, his beautiful song. I think he's calling his mate. But then I think, oh, don't try to interpret it, David. Just enjoy it. He says, when the heart becomes attuned to her restrained glimmerings, these glimpses of the divine, when the heart becomes attuned to these glimmerings, these glimpses of the divine, it learns to recognize her intimations most frequently in places that we have never lingered before. We stop, we look, and we hear that saying from the Quran, am I not your Lord? Yes, we witness you. Am I not the beauty of creation? Yes, we witness you. And it's always all around us, wherever we are. I remember as a little kid, Terry reminds me of my childhood. I don't know why your little boy awakens my little boy. I used to run away from my family to escape the crazies at home. There was a lot of screaming and yelling and alcoholism and you name it. So I found myself finding refuge in the dump. There's nothing greater than a little boy in the dump, because you get all this trash and you can turn it into a fort. And so I saw that ash heap, that dump, as the most beautiful place for me to escape to and find myself. So I was sitting in the living room reading this yesterday, and I looked out on my front porch, and all of a sudden there's a little wren looking at me from the window. Your wrens are cute little birds. They have their little tail that sticks up in the end, and he's making all kinds of sounds. And I thought, well, what are you trying to tell me? So I went out to the front porch, and lo and behold, this little wren has decided to make a nest on the front porch. And so he was checking me out to see if it's a safe place. He would fly to the swinging thing, then he went up into the corner, and he's either pursuing a female or he's making a nest to lure a female, but he's a busy little wren. And the whole morning I sat out there in the rocking chair watching the wren do his little thing. He can see beauty. So then near the end of the book, so he starts off by saying, we create in ourselves a receptive place to witness the beauty that's all around us, knowing that what we're really witnessing is the beauty within. And then near the end of the book, he talks about this beauty is the divine presence itself. It is God herself unveiling herself. Now, I use the word God lightly, because God, we need to expurge ourselves from the word God. And maybe think of it as presence. Think of it as light. Think of it as this loving something that we directly experience. And it's luminous, and it's awakening within its creation, and it's calling us to a greater order of being. So when we think about work, Khalil Gibran says, your work should be your worship. It doesn't matter what you do, it matters how you do it. One of the jobs that I have, because my husband loves to be in control, he's a triple one and I'm only a single one, and ones always want to be in control, so I let him have that role if he needs to be in control. And one of the things he likes to control more than anything is what we eat, because he's very diet conscious, like Raul is, and he knows what's healthy, and I think that's perfectly fine. But what he allows me to do in service, with a servant's heart, is to be his sous chef. So I get to chop up all the vegetables and do all this stuff, and in my own devious way, I'm telling him what I want to eat. And so it works out that way. You get to discover how to navigate. So here he talks about the visible and the invisible becoming one, or God awakening within us and calling us. And he says, in beauty we were dreamed, and we were created, and we were offered a life, the life that we've each been given. In a world where beauty arises to awaken us, to surprise us, and to call us. Now, when I read something like that, I take it within and I say, where am I called by this beauty? Well, obviously, I'm called to it through my garden. Charlotte's called to it through painting rocks. Jude is called to it through sailing on the ship and connecting with the water. Gigi's called to it every time she dives in salt water. She said, there's something about when I'm in salt water, my soul smiles. So where are we called to this beauty? John O'Donohue's asking, because that's the divine calling us. And he says, this outer unfolding of our lives is internally sustained and ordered by an invisible beauty. We're being sustained by this invisible beauty that we're now beginning to see in the world. It's our own self. Beauty in front of me, beauty behind me, beauty above me, beauty below me. I am on the pollen path. I am witnessing it everywhere, even on the border with the children crossing. You know, they show these ships fleeing from Somalia, coming over to Italy, and people who can't swim are on these little rafts, fighting for their freedom. There's something really beautiful about seeing people taking their life and their freedom in hand. You know, freedom isn't something the world gives you. Freedom is something you take. The freedom to believe and worship the way you want to. The freedom to marry whom you want to. The freedom to live where you want to. And we have to take that freedom. So could we take the beauty as well? He goes on to say, furthermore, whenever we awaken this beauty, we are helping to make God present in the world. Don't you love it? The beauty of God is reachable for everyone and can be awakened in all dimensions of our experience. Every single moment, chopping the vegetables in the kitchen is a God experience for me. Walking my dogs is a God experience. I have a pug who survived a herniated disc, who's learning to walk and climb the stairs. He is so precious to me. He makes me laugh. I have an old dog who can barely walk, and he is so precious to me because now I'm serving him, lifting him up and down as he goes down the stairs, and he waddles out to the kitchen and I make him raviolis with turkey and sweet potatoes and Rimadyl for his hips. He gets that Rimadyl. He says, the beauty of God is reachable for everyone and everything. This calls us to a love and a respect for the world, and it calls us to care for our earth. You begin to realize that this garden that we're in, the Garden of Eden, is still here. It's a state of consciousness. You know, in the Bible, it's all an allegory from the beginning to the end. We start off in Eden, which is a consciousness of oneness and bliss. And in Revelations, we end up in New Jerusalem, which is also that consciousness of peace. So in essence, the Bible is like a template of what our life is. We start off in this blissful consciousness. We go for forgetfulness. You might say we sin. We identify with the attachments of materialism. Our identity is an ego. And then we realize how shallow that is and that something greater begins to awaken. And that's that whole metaphor of crucifixion and resurrection. You know, we're going to be having Easter coming up soon. We don't do the Jesus Easter thing. We do the Ernest Holmes thing, who says you have to have your own resurrection. It's a template. So what needs to die and then what needs to resurrect? Maybe it's the old story that needs to die, so that this new life without a story. Could we have a life without a story? I wonder what that would look like. Yet the story is still there, but we're not identifying with it. And we almost can look at it as somebody else's life. You know, I used to be there, but now I'm a different being because I've evolved. So he goes on to say, accompanied by beauty, truth gains graciousness and compassion, and beauty holds harmony at the heart of unity and prevents its collapse into the most haunted chaos. In the presence of beauty, goodness attracts desire, and beauty makes presence luminous and evokes its mystery in us. This beauty becomes awakened within us. Its luminosity attracts to us what is ours to do and to be. Then we don't have to chase after it. It literally, anything that we do, from chopping the vegetables to walking the dog, becomes a sacred act where we can see the beauty within us and all around us. He concludes this book by choosing the contemplative path. The contemplative path is where wherever I look, I see the face of God, and that's the path that ends up seeing beauty everywhere. This is the end of the book. He says, the truly contemplative heart has a passion and a wildness that can celebrate the magic of God everywhere. Everywhere. He says, the contemplative heart learns to love emptiness and absence because it believes that the beauty of God can only be glimpsed through the most severe lens of truth. Sometimes we have to lose everything. Sylvia lost beautiful Joe in form, but his spirit is still here. So what if when we lose the form, we never lose the love or the essence? And you know, it's so funny, Gigi made me a beautiful collage of my pets, and I look at it every time I come in the bookstore. There's my baby girl, baby Speck, in the two corners. She's now in heaven. She's in heaven with Smudge, and I look in that picture. There's the flower that fills my garden, everywhere present. And then there's Humphrey, who's still alive. In the photograph, he has two eyes now. He's down to one eye, my little cyclops. And there's Bert in the photograph, a young version of Bert. Now he's an ancient version. But as I look at that, they're all still here, and the love is still there. That's the beauty of living a contemplative life. He says, an atmosphere of stillness and a sense of clarity remind us of who we are and recall our heart to this gentle wonder of the divine. Doesn't that feel nice? It recalls our heart to the gentle wonder of the divine. To have a beginner's heart, the wonder of the divine. You know, and then we live our life not seeking out the beauty, but seeing the beauty that's there everywhere. It's just everywhere. We're doing this class about the three commitments. And I think I share with you the first commitment is to do no harm and to always do your best. The second commitment is the path of the Bodhisattva, which is the path of serving the suffering on the planet to abate the suffering. You know, if someone's like, when Humphrey is suffering, I pick him up and I love him. I don't try to fix him, I just love him. So that's the path of the Bodhisattva. The third path, it's very interesting, is to accept life just as it is without reacting to it. Now that's a pretty powerful commitment. We have a COVID, coronavirus. We have political upheaval in this country. We have Black Lives Matter movements. We had an insurrection. Could we be with all of that without reaction, but to know that this is part of the crucifixion so that a resurrection of a higher order of being can evolve through each of us in consciousness? I truly think that our country is going to be better and stronger and more committed as we each participate in this democracy that we've been given. But I wanted to end with maybe a fourth commitment that she doesn't talk about in Buddhism. And this is the commitment that Jean and I awoke to when we went to Ghost Ranch. When they took us into our heart and to the beauty of our soul, they asked, what does this heart, this soul, this beauty, what does it want? And Jean and I, surprisingly, or maybe not surprisingly, was we wanted hope. We consider hope to be a beautiful commitment. I commit to be hopeful. Call me a cockeyed optimist, Sylvie would probably say, but I am hopeful that we will see our better angels, that we will learn to love one another, you know, that neighbors that don't get along will start being kind to one another, and that we as a country will come together with a higher purpose to serve humanity. And this is for you, Jean. There's this lovely little book called Heart Songs by Matty Stepanek. This is a young boy who died at age 13 from muscular dystrophy. And he lost his siblings, it was a genetic thing, and yet he never lost his hope. He never lost his heart song. And he was so generous of spirit that you talk about someone who relieved the suffering on the planet, he did more good. I would see him on the Phil Donahue show, maybe way back when. And this is his little poem called Hope, which he wrote when he was 11 years old in 1999. He died in the year 2001 at age 13. But his message lives on, and I want to use that as the closing for our meditation at the end. This is Matty Stepanek, age 11. He says, I need a hope. I need a new hope. A hope that reaches for the stars and that does not end in violence or war. A hope that makes peace on our earth and that does not create evil in our world. A hope that finds cures for all diseases and that does not make people hurt in their bodies, in their hearts, and most of all in their spirits. I need a hope, a new hope, a hope that inspires me to live and to make all these things happen so that the whole world can have a new hope too. I need a hope, a new hope. So let's fall into the breath again and enter into that heart space where Matty spoke from and made a plea, a cry to the universe, a plea for something to arise within him, which was a new hope, a hope that our better angels will arise on the planet, a hope that we will, as Jesus said, love one another. Just love one another. A hope that we will face whatever disease, dis-ease on the planet and bring the bodhisattva, compassion and embrace to this suffering so that we won't suffer in body, mind or spirit. He awoke within us this new hope that we don't need violence or war in order to conquer evil, but rather we can hopefully face the dark times and the uncomfortable challenges in life with a hope-filled heart that each of us will discover the way that is right for us as we together create a new world. It says in the book of Revelations, "And behold, there will be a new heaven and a new earth. And the voice within declares, behold, I make all things new." And so this new heaven is that space within us, that beauty within us that is awakening, that illumines our way, that calls us into a greater order of being. And the new earth is the way it outpictures in our relationships, in our work, in our play. The new earth is how it manifests here on planet Earth. And as time and space collapse, we enter into a timeless, eternal now moment, which says, behold, I make all things new. So we invite that newness to awaken within us, that new hope for possibility. Dr. Ernest Holmes refers to the presence of God as the totality of possibilities. So what if we could open to the totality of possibilities with a new hope, with a regained state of gratitude in our hearts for all the good that is right now, for the beauty that surrounds us, and we see it because we are it. Then we have discovered that wholeness within ourselves that isn't hidden anymore, but that is exposed, that is real, that is alive, and is on the move through each one of us. Just as love sees only love, the beauty within sees only the beauty without. And we discover this beauty of life, then every threshold that we go through is yet a crucifixion as a resurrection. It's the death of an old idea and the birth of a possibility. And we are living this dynamic, each one of us, with every breath that we breathe, with every step that we take. Beauty within us and beauty all around us. It shines forth and we see it. I was a hidden treasure and I longed to be known. So I created this beautiful life that we share. It's with gratitude, with playfulness, and with great honor that we say yes, 1,000 times yes. Place your hands over that hopeful heart of yours with me, and let's join in the heart salutation by saying together, I honor you.
I honor you.
I respect you.
I respect you.
I love you.
You
are the deepest aspect of myself. The beauty within me bows to the beauty within you. And as we rest in that, we are living life beautifully. And all unfolds with ease and grace. We fall into grace. And we say yes. Open your eyes, open your hearts. You already made your declaration and your commitment, and hope abides. Thank you for sharing. Thank you for sending in your tithes. Safe distance. Go register for your shot.
For more information, please visit www.cslhuntsville.org. You are love and you are light. Namaste. Yeah!